From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Yesterday, we asked you to tell us about what's happening to your loved ones who are in nursing homes. Here are just a few of the many stories you shared.
We lost a friend's parents last week, 4 days apart. Both of those adults lived in an assisted living where they were infected by a home health worker. Our home health situation, our national health care situation, is in critical need.
There is not a doubt in my mind that the coronavirus was spread unwillingly by AIDS, because they are overworked, underpaid, and they have people not showing up all the time because of the pay rates and how they're worked. I mean, these young women, mostly young women, are working their tails off. And the top dogs, the private for profit industry, is making money off their backs.
I understand that few family members have the luxury of becoming a full-time companion to an aged parent and thus being able to monitor what goes on in these facilities. But it is distressing that our beloved elderly are at the mercy of a system that is imperfect at best and sometimes downright harmful.
On Point listeners Mary from Marshfield, Massachusetts, Kathleen from Dayton, Ohio, and Eleanor from Lexington, Kentucky. Well, as we've been saying, this pandemic is holding up an inescapable mirror on our nation. When it comes to elder treatment, the image it's reflecting back is a tragic one. We do not want to look away. It's time to talk about how society and the healthcare system treat and view America's elderly, and what we must do about it. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And we are going to begin with Danielle Ivory. She's an investigative reporter for The New York Times. And she and her team have been working on tracking every COVID-19 death in America. She joins us via Skype from Ridgewood, New Jersey. Danielle, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So at this point in time, how many of the fatalities from COVID-19 in the United States have happened inside American nursing homes?
We can link nearly a quarter of the deaths in the pandemic to long-term care facilities. That would include deaths of residents who live in these facilities and also staff members who work in them.
So a quarter of them, 25% connected to long-term care facilities.
Almost a quarter, yeah.
It's a huge number. Tell us more about what you found, because your latest piece has got this headline, "They're death pits." I mean, what have you been finding in your tracking?
Well, we've been looking at nursing homes and long-term care facilities across the country and trying to identify where there have been cases and where there have been deaths. And we have been able to find, at this point, nearly 5,000 long-term care facilities with coronavirus cases, where more than 50,000 residents and staff members have contracted the virus, and we're now nearing about 10,000 who have died from this virus. We have been seeing that nursing homes are really having trouble getting adequate protective gear, like masks. Sometimes when they have that gear, they don't enforce policies requiring residents and staff to wear them. We have also seen problems with adequate testing in these facilities as well. Sometimes that's because the nursing homes and long-term care facilities have trouble getting access to testing. Sometimes that's because they have official or unofficial policies where they will only test people who are symptomatic. And as you know, you can carry this virus asymptomatically and pass it to others. And we also, as one of your listeners pointed out, we have seen that workers in these facilities who are heroically working on the front lines in many of these cases are underpaid and overworked and moving from facility to facility, which is exacerbating the crisis.
Mm. Well, let's talk about that a little bit more, because you, for example, in your story, you quote the former lieutenant governor of New York, Betsy McCaughey, did I say her name right?
I believe that's
okay.
Right.
Okay. She talked to you about how the pandemic has revealed a problem that was already existing in these long-term care facilities, in these nursing homes. The fact that staff are overwhelmed and frequently it's quite crowded. So, in fact, the stage was set for something devastating like this to happen.
Indeed. I'm sure you and your listeners have heard of the nursing home in New Jersey where there were literally bodies stacked up in the back and the police had to be called. There was someone who had talked to us about that story who said, like, this is a facility that the state should have been looking at already. This is not a problem that started with the coronavirus pandemic. Many of these nursing homes already had serious problems of resourcing and staffing and crowdedness as well.
Mm. And I'm seeing in your reporting here, you talked about the 7,000 deaths that have happened in these facilities. There's also, as you reported, almost 37,000 cases, right, overall.
Yeah, let's see, overall, because we've been trying to track these cases in as close to real time as possible. Overall, we're at about 40,000 deaths across the nation, and we're nearing about 10,000 nursing home related deaths, either of residents or staff. So those numbers have gotten significantly worse, actually, since we reported that story last week.
So, Danielle, there's something I just want to make clear here. Your team at the New York Times is trying to individually track these cases, which A, is a job of journalism, but B, it's actually interesting that that effort has to happen, right? Because part of the problem is we still don't really know. And the information is even harder to come by when it comes to understanding what's happening inside these long-term care facilities. Isn't that right?
Yeah, these numbers have been very difficult to track. States are, I think, more and more as time goes on, are starting to put out more of these numbers, either in an aggregated way where we can see just overall numbers. And then there's also some states that are putting out lists of facilities. And then there's a very small number of states that are putting out lists of facilities with their cases and their deaths. This is not something that the federal government has been, like, they don't publish lists of facilities in the United States that have these cases. But after our story came out on Friday, there was a commitment from the Trump administration to start putting out some of this information and to require nursing homes to report any cases of coronavirus to families who have loved ones in these nursing homes.
Well,
that was not a requirement beforehand.
Not until Sunday, as you just said. So in fact, I want to just play the announcement that was made by Seema Verma, who's the administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And here's what she said on Sunday.
Today, we are announcing that we are requiring nursing homes to report to patients and their families if there are cases of COVID virus inside the nursing home. We are also requiring nursing homes to report directly to the CDC when they have cases of COVID virus.
So that's Administrator Seema Verma, Administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Danielle, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about a particular facility that you spoke with people who work there, the Canterbury Nursing Home in Virginia.
Sure. So that's a facility in Richmond that has had one of the highest death tolls in the country. At least 46 residents have died there. And it's an interesting case. We talked to the medical director there, who was very transparent with us. He said it was under-resourced to begin with, understaffed. It's become more understaffed during the crisis, in part because staff have been getting sick and because they, you know, are afraid to come in. It's also, it houses a population of people who rely mostly on Medicaid. So they are mostly impoverished. the virus got into that facility fairly early on in mid-March, and the numbers just started to skyrocket. And finally, by the end of March, the Virginia Health Department decided they were going to test everyone in the facility. And when they did that, they found that, you know, more than 60 people in this about 160 bed facility were positive, but about 50 of them were asymptomatic. So there would have been no way of knowing without doing those tests that so many people in the facility were carrying the virus. And the medical director talked about that as just like a nightmare moment where they realized that something they thought they had under control was just completely spiraling out of control.
Mm. We've got a minute left to go with you, Danielle. In the process of your ongoing process of reporting this story, are people telling you that this is one of those gut check moments that we can't pretend that we don't have issues with elder care in this country anymore because it's there for all of us to see now?
Yeah, the medical director at the Canterbury facility in Virginia said this thing to me that has really stuck with me. And he was a little emotional when he said it, I think, because he's been just dealing with watching residents and staff get very, very ill, and some of them have died. But he said that this is, we made a societal decision to put our elders in these facilities that are sometimes very small, sometimes don't have access to the outdoors, and are often very under-resourced. And he just felt that this is a time when maybe we should reconsider warehousing our elderly and think about a new way of taking care of them.
Well, Danielle Ivory is an investigative reporter for The New York Times. Her team is working on tracking every COVID-19 death in America. Danielle, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We have a lot more to talk about elder care in America when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the mirror that the COVID-19 pandemic is holding up to elder care in America. And yesterday we asked our listeners to give us a call with your stories about elderly loved ones in your life or about your life that you're living right now, especially if there's someone that you know who's living in an assisted living facility or a nursing home. And here's several more of the many voicemails that we received.
She doesn't get that I can't be there with her. And then, of course, there's the fear that overtakes me when I think of the very real possibility that she could contract COVID-19, since there are, at last count, 10 cases in her nursing home, and end up dying alone without her family. Believe me, this would haunt me for the rest of my life.
I was allowed to come to his window to speak to him on Easter Day. He knows that he's not going to get well and that he has to be in a room by himself with nothing but a future that at this point he has to face alone.
In some circumstances, we even serve as guardian of patients and had a circumstance in which the patient was experiencing symptoms of COVID-19, and we requested that the facility test the patient, but were told that they weren't testing because there was no point, even if it came back positive.
That was Kim from Wakefield, Rhode Island, Christine from Moravia, New York, and Michael a licensed clinical social worker in Atlanta, Georgia, just a couple of the mountain of voicemails we received from On Point listeners. Well, joining us now is Dr. Louise Aronson. She's with us from San Francisco, California. She's professor of geriatrics at the University of California, San Francisco, and author of Elderhood, Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, and Reimagining Life. Dr. Aronson, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Magna. It's nice to be here.
I wonder first if we could actually just start with your assessment on the numbers that we're seeing so far. You heard Danielle talk about the fact that they've been able to track down at least 7,000 deaths that have occurred in U.S. nursing homes because of COVID-19. Do you think that that's an accurate number?
No. I mean, excuse me, everybody's guess is that it's an under and a number that is probably way below the real numbers. And this is for a variety of reasons. We have very little testing in the United States compared to some countries. And we also have tests that aren't always accurate, which has recently been covered by the New York Times and others. So that if a person has a negative test, we don't necessarily know that it's negative and vice versa. But a lot of places haven't gotten tests. If you think of the number of healthcare workers on the front lines who can't get tested, just imagine how likely it is for a nursing home out of sight, out of mind to get enough tests for their residents and staff. There are also ways people can die both directly and indirectly from COVID-19. Mm. So I imagine that not only are people getting it and dying, but people with other problems are not being sent to the hospital or not being seen by clinicians who could help treat them. And so there are probably direct and indirect deaths.
Right. So this is a really complex issue because there are societal issues that flow through the question of elder care. There's pure medical and physiological issues. And then there's also the question of this particular virus. We don't yet fully understand why this virus itself might be much more dangerous to older people. Because I'm thinking that there are other pandemics we've been through, the 1918 pandemic, for example, that was particularly deadly to young people. But that's not the case here. We don't yet understand that physiology for COVID-19.
Yeah, correct. And we also have to remember that our situation as a society is quite different now than it was in 1918 when there were we really had a population pyramid, tons and tons of kids and very few elders. Uh-huh. And so we don't necessarily see what happened then, although you could see in society that younger people were more affected. So it's true we don't know. We do know that generally when people become sick, elders are at higher risk. We all know that as we get older, you end up having more health problems. And this virus seems to go to all parts of the body. You know, sometimes, you know, we think of the lungs as being affected, but we're also seeing blood clots, liver problems, kidney failure, people getting better and then suddenly going into heart failure, all kinds of neurological things. And with advancing age, each of those organs has a little bit or sometimes a lot less resilience than it did before. So part of it may be that it goes to so many parts of the body and there is just vulnerability throughout all those parts as we get older.
I see. Let's just hit a particular question head on. It's a little uncomfortable, but you ask us to consider it in a piece that you wrote for The Atlantic. And that is, I mean, 1918 is a good example. What if this time around, most of the fatalities occurred in young people? I mean, you ask if we had 45,000 deaths and it was mostly kids, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, would we be reacting differently? Would we have reacted earlier? Would we have undertaken what we needed to do to get a control of this pandemic much, much faster? What do you think?
I think so. You know, we were seeing the numbers from other countries and not really responding. And there were comments such as the boomer remover. Although if you want to be more accurate, the boomers are still, you know, 50s to 70s. So on the young end of old age and some, you know, strictly middle aged still. So it's the generation above that. It's the boomers' parents particularly that are dying. But I think if kids were dying, you wouldn't have seen something like that. On the other hand, I have been hugely impressed and very hopeful by the amount of coverage that the dying older people are getting and that our society's way of coping with advanced old age is getting. I'm hoping that although this is, you know, undeniably a tragedy, that the focus that you and others are putting on this will help us do a much better job. Because the fact is, most of us are going to become quite old, and it's something that scares most people, and it really doesn't have to if we had a society set up to treat elders the way we already treat many children, obviously not all, many children and adults. Mm. But we sort of create a society for children and adults, and then we blame old age for the challenges old people face in that society.
Okay, but just to be clear, I mean, you are, in the piece that you wrote for The Atlantic, you do ask out loud if ageism is making this pandemic worse. And I think that might be hard for some people to acknowledge, because this pandemic has also stopped the world, it feels like. But I take your point that would we have reacted differently? Because you write that ageism has always shaped the kind of medical care that older Americans receive anyway. So tell me more about that.
Okay, so our entire healthcare system is really set up for children and adults. And that's part of what I was speaking to. And I was saying it at my, you know, super top, fantastic health center, where they just transformed services with such hard work to deal with this pandemic. I mean, the response was amazing. And yet, we had immediately protocols for how to deal with sick kids, and shortly thereafter, protocols for how to deal with sick adults. Now, as we've learned, there have been some deaths of children, and that's obviously never okay, but we knew when those protocols were made, we already knew that the vast majority of deaths in China and in Italy were in old people. And yet, even to this day, the elderly are sort of tacked on to the adult protocols. And this is just basically a mirror onto our healthcare system, where we have children's hospitals and adult hospitals, and we have pediatric specialists and adult specialists. And yet, if you took a kid, an adult, and an elder, even the kid could tell you those three were different. Mm-hmm. They're different in how they look. They're different in how their bodies react to medications. They're different in how they spend their days. And we acknowledge that for kids, and, you know, as opposed to adults, which are the standard, because adults are usually the ones creating the standards, right? But we don't acknowledge it well for elders. And one of the places we're really seeing that in this pandemic is that we put elders into these nursing homes. And sometimes that can be terrific, a social environment. Many of us cluster by our own age anyway. And sometimes it's out of sight, out of mind. We don't want to deal with this. Your needs are different. We're going to push you into a sort of a second-class citizenry, officially and structurally.
Hmm. I want to return to that thought in a second, but all of a sudden I was thinking of the mirror again, the mirror, right, that this pandemic, yes, is holding up. But regarding elder care and how our society views the elderly, I'm thinking of Italy and the problem they had there or have there. It wasn't actually seen as a problem before. All these intergenerational households where you have the elderly living right alongside their grandchildren or great-grandchildren. That might have been the engine that allowed the novel coronavirus to spread as rapidly as it did in Italy. So kind of a different model for how we view elders, and yet a similar outcome.
Ooh, that's such a good point. Yes. I guess you could argue it in a variety of ways. We had the benefit of, you know, Italy's experience. And I think when it happened to Italy, we had less understanding of how the virus is transmitted and just how many asymptomatic people were around. I also don't know enough about Italy's health system and how they approach things. We know from the United States that rates of death of people on ventilators are quite different, for example, in New York than in California. And some of that has to do with who do you put on a ventilator? And that sounds really draconian. But we know in this epidemic that if you already have severe disease, and particularly if you have multiple diseases in multiple organs and you're over age 80, your chances of coming off that ventilator are really, really slim. But what we didn't do, and this is one of the things about elder care, was give people the options of, you know, if you're doing well, fantastic, let's support you. If you're doing a little less well, let's look at your other diseases and see what supports you need beyond the ones we're doing for healthy younger people who have the same amount of viral disease. And then if you're really old and really frail, you pick. Some people, in my patients and my colleagues' patients, some people don't really want any of those treatments. More people do, but what they don't want is the ventilator. And when you have a crisis like this and you haven't done what good elder care is, which is to really find out who is this human being, what does he or she value most in their lives, a lot of people would want for sure treatment of the virus to the best of the ability of the medical system, short of having that breathing tube in. Because what we're finding is that people have it for weeks and months and that they are not the same when they come off it. And if you take a healthy 26-year-old, walking and thinking, what happens if you have an 85-year-old with dementia and heart disease? A lot of people would choose, if they get to that severe, exceptional situation, to pick palliative care. Similarly, one of the things we talk about a lot in geriatrics is that sometimes you can't fix a problem, right? We all know this about aging. But most people, as they get older, will have many problems. And if we can make a few of those better, we can often make the person better. And so an elder care approach to this would also look not just at the virus, but at some of these other systems. And how do we support this person so we don't get to that point of the ventilator? And then if we do get there, how do we know what this specific, unique human being wants and prefers? And those things would be much earlier in protocols if we were really thinking about, you know, with a geriatrics lens, with the lens of the people who specialize in the bodies, lives, and medical care of older adults.
You know, but Dr. Aronson, hearing you describe what excellence in elder care looks like or should look like, to me, you're also defining what excellence in care, period, should look like, right?
That's sort of how my book came to being Elderhood, because I realized I was writing things about the health system and I was writing things about elders and geriatrics. And then I thought, wait, and this is often the case in healthcare and probably in life, that if you could take really good care of the people who need it most, you can take really good care of everyone. And that's why doing this better would actually benefit the whole health system and our whole population.
Mm. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about that medicine overall sees adults as adults, whether they're 25 or 85. If we were to shift that a little bit, I mean, what would change?
Right. Well, and admittedly, where you draw that line is a little arbitrary, right? We all know 74-year-olds that are in fantastic shape and 52-year-olds that aren't. You know, but we also know 16-year-olds who are super mature and 26-year-olds who aren't. So, you know, each of these things has different dividing lines. But I think if we acknowledge the difference, we would have less of two things that have been getting increasing attention in medicine lately: over-treatment, which is when you give the adult-based treatment to someone who is an elder and it doesn't go well, and then we often blame old age. And this has its origins actually in medical research, because often, and this is true for COVID research also, for vaccine research, we say we're not going to include elders in our trials of these medications or procedures because they have other illnesses, it's just too complicated, it's hard to recruit them. And so we do the studies on younger and middle-aged people, and then we apply the results to the older people, having already said the older people were different. And then when we get different results, we don't blame our, you know, bad science and faulty assumptions, we blame old age. Of note, in the United States, we required the inclusion for these very same reasons. We required the inclusion of women and people of color in medical research in the 1980s. We required the inclusion of children in the 1990s. And we did not require the inclusion of older adults in medical research until 2019. So often, people are subject to overtreatment, and this can be sort of subtle things like the dose is too big for the changed metabolism. It can be that the approach is simply wrong or does more harm than good based on how a person's body is and what their life expectancy is. A lot of our surgical colleagues are doing some great research in these areas now. But there is also something called undertreatment, which matters as well, which is when you look only at age.
Yeah.
And you don't look at one of the things we geriatricians really value that isn't a part of adult medicine, and that is what we call functional status.
Well, Dr. Aronson, if you hang on here for just a second, I want to hear a lot more about what functional status is when we come back from this quick break. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about what the COVID-19 pandemic reveals about elder care in America, and I'm joined by Dr. Louise Aronson. She's a professor of geriatrics at the University of California, San Francisco, and author of the best-selling Elderhood, Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, and Reimagining Life. And as I said, we received a record number of voicemails from On Point listeners about this topic. Here's some more.
There's no longer a dignity in growing old. These corporations running the elder care facilities and the health care facilities, to me, it just looks like they've united to use the elderly as their personal piggy banks.
We do remain locked down. Our entranceways are even blocked from inside and outside, and people going and coming are registered. And when they return, they're screened. So it's a rigid way of living. However, we're hoping for the best.
Our seniors are not all dawdling and ready to follow their needs. Where I live, most, almost all of the people, pretty healthy.
You just heard Carl from Wausau, Wisconsin, Calvin from Daleville, Virginia, and Marilyn from Boston, Massachusetts. Now, Dr. Aronson, you were talking before the break about functional status. Can you tell us more about what that is?
So that's really just it's kind of a measure of fitness or ability to function. So, for instance, in a Wall Street Journal article last month, a doctor was discussing the illness on the Princess cruise ship and was saying, well, these aren't like other 75-year-olds. You know, they're not sitting home in wheelchairs. Well, most 75-year-olds aren't. So if you think about, say, Tony Fauci, who's 79 and is leading this and is probably working 80 to 100 hours a week, that's one vision of 79. That's 79 with what we would call a high functional status. But if you have pretty advanced Alzheimer's and maybe you smoked for 50 years, you might be in a wheelchair with some oxygen, and that is very low functional status. There are actually these measures we use in geriatrics which predict hospitalizations and hospital outcomes better than the usual things we think of, the list of diagnoses, etc. And there are things that are really simple, like what's your grip strength? How quickly can you walk? Can you walk up a flight of stairs? Things like that help us look not at a person's age, but at a person's fitness. And that's not to say this person gets treatment and that person doesn't. What we say is, let's match the appropriate treatment to who you are, what you value, and what your functional status is, because something that's really safe in a highly fit 87-year-old might be quite dangerous and even lethal to a more frail 87-year-old. So it's about looking not just at age, but at the person and how they function.
Okay. Well, so Dr. Aronson, we have to talk more specifically, though, about nursing homes or assisted living facilities, because just to put some numbers on it, it's a huge part of what elder care is in the United States. I mean, I'm seeing some figures here that the assisted living facility market in 2018 in the United States was almost $74 billion. There's a lot of variety within that. I want to acknowledge that. And thousands upon thousands of people who are working very hard. But I'm just, you know, what is your take? What is your view about where we are regarding assisted living or nursing homes that has exacerbated wildly this pandemic?
Well, I'd say one of the key things is, you know, in any congregate setting, you have a risk for infections to spread. We see this in colleges with, you know, epidemics of mumps or things like that, measles. But what we've done in these facilities is we've also devalued the people who work there. Generally, these are very poorly paid people, actually so poorly paid that the vast majority of them work in multiple facilities. That means that if there was COVID in one facility, a worker could unwittingly bring it to another facility just because she or he was trying to make enough money to support themselves or their family to pay the rent and to buy food. We don't give a whole lot of training. We don't have pathways. You know, how do you incentivize people in their jobs? You give them options or pathways for a better life. And there really isn't that. So there's and it's very hard work, right? It's such hard work that most families actually won't do it themselves at a certain point. So it's that hard, and we claim to be a country based on family values, and yet we outsource it, and then the people who do the work get really poorly paid. They don't have the safety measures, right? I mean, we're hearing about PPE limits in hospitals. It is so much worse in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. So we really have set ourselves up for this disaster. And the question is, will we do better and differently going forward? I certainly hope so.
Well, I want to hear from, again, some listeners who shared their stories with us. This is Tim from Baltimore, and he says his mother at a facility was cared for primarily by immigrants in her nursing home who cared for her before she passed away.
The place was staffed very disproportionately with immigrants, mostly West African immigrants, and they were golden. They were great. These were the first jobs I think that they would be getting as new immigrants. And as they got experience, they would lead for better opportunities. And my concern is now that there are not going to be people to take their places with Trump's immigration ban.
That's Tim from Baltimore. And here's Barbara. She called us from Blaine Rock, North Carolina. Her mother is 95 and has lived in a nursing home in Nebraska for the past 7 years.
The director tells me that there's a real problem because of a gap in the Medicaid payments, but they lose money every day on residents that are Medicaid funded because there's not enough funding. And it's a real concern. The larger nursing home in a larger town 50 miles away has stopped taking those kinds of residents. But the director was telling me that she said, we don't want to do that here in our town. These are our friends and neighbors. But it's really hard to sustain that when nursing homes are losing money on that.
That's Barbara from Blaine Rock, North Carolina. Dr. Aronson, I was wondering if you wanted to respond to that, that there are, especially for elders who need very specific types of care that may only be able to be provided in these facilities, that there are some serious financial challenges.
Absolutely. Those callers made such good comments. Actually, all your callers have. So a huge percentage of this work is done by immigrants, and a much larger percentage by people of color and people level job. It's the sort of job people with greater status in society and more opportunities tend not to take. And so when we close immigration, we really are closing off opportunities to get the sort of elder care we need. It is also true, and it has been known for many, many decades, that nursing homes get less payment from Medicaid. So there are many that simply won't take those patients, or sometimes they have tiered care, where if you're on Medicaid, you get less good care than if you can be private pay. That was actually part of the incentive for the assisted living industry, because those are pretty much all private pay. And so they're appealing to people who have higher income, and the idea was that that would be more lucrative. In some cases, it also buys a different quality of life, but initially, people who went into assisted living were healthier. But because of the reputation of nursing homes, some deserved and some not, there are homes in which people are very happy. People preferentially went into assisted living, and now you get really frail people in assisted living, a situation with less of the nursing support than a nursing home would have, of course. So we tend not to realize that our immigration issues, our racial issues, our economic issues all pertain to old age.
Well, you know, this is a perfect moment to bring in someone who knows this firsthand because they work in the industry. Bruce Folsom joins us now from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Bruce spent 8 years as a supervisor for a long-term care facility, and he travels to nursing homes throughout the state for his job. And he actually called us yesterday, and we wanted to bring him on the show today. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks.
Hi. I was wondering, what motivated you to call us yesterday? What is it that you're seeing in your work day to day that you feel particularly strongly about right now?
Oh, well, I'm in a nursing home right now, and it's a mess because of COVID, but this mess has been here for a long time. Like you said, 8 years of being in this, it's criminal. It's really the staffing, the for-profit. You know, as an example, on an average place I go to, one CNA takes care of 13 people. You know, 13 people have finished dinner and they all got to go to the bathroom at once. It just doesn't happen. 13 people got to go do anything. It just doesn't happen. It's way, way understaffed, and it's all, I think, driven by how little can you get away with, how much money can you make.
Now, Bruce, you've been a registered nurse for 25 years, right? When you say, so the understaffing is part of the mess. I mean, what else are you seeing as the mess?
Oh, I think that's it. I think that is exactly it. Like, grandma and grandpa deserve a whole lot better shake than they're getting. Really. It's like, I think anybody that doesn't know what's going on, which is most of the people, think everything's okay. But if you go there, and I go there all the time, it's like I teach classes, and I say, if I was king, things would change. And they change a lot. It's really pathetic. You know, like the word ethics comes into play. It's bad.
Yeah.
And this COVID thing is just brings it to a front, but it's nothing new. And I think that we could, you know, as a society, do a whole lot better. I'd pay more taxes. I don't think this should be for profit. I don't think stockholders should be making any money off the deal. You know, the majority of the people here are getting supported by Medicaid.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, sorry.
Go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it sounds like those are some of the things that you would change if you were king. But I want you to help us with something, because, like you said, most people don't see what you see every day. Take us inside more. What else are you seeing that you would change?
Oh, well, ratios. You know, the whole ability for someone to be taken care of, to be listened to be taken to the bathroom, to be given a drink of water and not have to sit there and wait for 45 minutes. And mess their pants. and fall on the floor and break their hip. You know, and then, you know, the other thing is the staff. You know, I look at the staff because I deal with them all the time, too. And they're getting crushed. I think we should all, like, give them a group apology and say, we're sorry. Really? And because they have hard jobs. They have really hard jobs now. But they have hard jobs all the time. And they're, and you know what happens is they all call in sick. It's like, I'm getting crushed every day. I can't do it today. And then it's even worse. And it snowballs down, and it's all about, I think, how much money can you make?
Mm-hmm.
How little can you do it with? And it's like, that's the wrong answer.
Yeah.
It's how much do you need?
Bruce, can I just ask you one more question?
Sure.
How are you holding up?
Well, I get emotional talking about it. But I'm doing okay. I'm working my butt off.
Okay. Well, Bruce Folsom, a registered nurse for 25 years. He spends his time as a supervisor for a long-term care facility in nursing homes throughout the state of Massachusetts for his job. Bruce, thank you. Thank you for giving us that inside view and for your work.
Sure. The story's a little wrong, but you're pretty close.
Okay. Well, what did I get wrong? What did I get wrong?
I was a supervisor. I place IVs. I go to different places and do infusion stuff.
Okay.
And these long-term care facilities.
Okay. That was my mistake, but thank you for correcting me, Bruce.
No worries.
Dr. Aronson, I think you heard Bruce's plaintive plea there about the motivation that he sees in terms of the profit side of nursing homes or assisted living facilities. Just your response to that.
Well, we're seeing that here in San Francisco. There is one facility that has been a known bad actor for a while and has had past citations and has by far the most cases in both staff and residents. And it's hard to figure out even who owns it. And to get a reply from them, our local newspaper was covering it, and this is pretty typical. There is oversight. You know, we've got our local and state health departments. But for example, when the California was reporting number of cases, they said, well, here's what we know, but we don't know if the other places don't have cases or they just didn't respond. How is it okay not to respond? And then there are things of, well, how do you let so many people get sick? Well, if you don't have paid sick leave, and you can just barely make your rent as it is, you're going to go into work even if you're sick. So we literally set ourselves up financially for these disasters where people are allowed to make profit for the suffering of others. And by the suffering, I mean both the workers and the residents. We as a system can do so much better. But there are also things that seem unrelated but really are. For instance, if you have a new baby, that's a person who needs a lot of care, but there's so much support from society. There's so much information. A study a little over a year ago showed that only 7% of family caregivers get any training in how to care for their elderly family member. And nobody's going to like a job or do it well or feel like it's okay if they're not even given any support in how to do that. And so then people end up in facilities. And then we don't support the care workers there, either financially or in terms of what Bruce was saying, staffing ratios.
Right.
He's just right. You can't have 13 people at the same time having the same needs.
Well, you know, this pandemic is certainly opening the nation's eyes to issues that have been there before us for a long time. The question is now, will we take steps forward to do something about it? So Dr. Louise Aronson, professor of geriatrics at the University of California, San Francisco, and author of Elderhood. Dr. Aronson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for covering this.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.